Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
I hope the moms had an enjoyable Mother's Day. Welcome everyone to Nightlight. We've got a little out there over the last few shows. We'll be more down to earth tonight. It's mid-May and Colorado had a snowstorm. I have a frost warning for the next few nights, which will be about 4 days past the traditional last frost day. So if you are tired of a 7-month-long winter, let's go on a virtual vacation to the beach tonight. When we think of 18th century America, probably we think of the founding documents, or George Washington set the precedents for, say, American exceptionalism. There's probably a couple things that first come to mind. But there were many other names from this period that had notable achievements, but we may have forgotten who they were, but this show is designed for us to keep alive their legacies. For example, you know, there's John James Audubon and his studies and paintings of birds. John Singleton Copley painted the realistic Watson and the shark, and we gaze in suspense. You know, did the sailors pull Watson to safety, or did the shark get to Watson first? You know, what's the story that happened after Watson did this painting? Charles Wilson Peale had his first American museum in the upper floor of Independence Hall, and he painted an excavation of a mastodon in New York, and you know, there's the famous painting of him lifting a curtain to give, you know, the viewers a glimpse of his museum. And his sons were also celebrated artists, and they had a museum in Baltimore. George Catlin and others, other artists did portraits of Native chiefs. You know, there's just a lot of people who used artwork to celebrates, you know, America's landscape. One name we may not remember as well is William Bartram, but he left just as an important legacy as the others I just mentioned. He traveled through the Southeast and Gulf Coast colonies and was one of the first to document the plants, wildlife and customs of the Cherokee, Yuchi, Seminole, and of course I have to mention the Creek, since Vera made me an honorary member. To give us our history lesson tonight, we have Brad Sanders. He is the author of the fabulous Guide to William Bartram's Travels. He's also a small independent publisher. You can learn more about him at fevertreepress.com. And he's also a retired history teacher. Hi, Brad. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing fine. But I was not a history teacher. I taught graphic arts.
Oh, I'm sorry. Graphic art. Make that correction. Write like a college history professor.
Oh,
have a,
well, that may be good and that may not be good.
Well, I was intending it to be a compliment.
Yeah. Well, but, thank you very much.
I'm sure it was. And, you know, I came across your book probably about 10 years ago. I took kids to this, like, two-day, one-night field trip to Baltimore and Philadelphia. And I think our last stop before making our way home was to Bartram's Gardens. And had, you know, just fantastic experience there. And so I picked up your book, and yeah, it's, recommended you for one show several years ago. And at least when I approached you about returning to my show, yeah, you were interested. So at least you didn't say no. So I got you here. So yeah, I think we're gonna have a really good talk tonight. And I've just, since I've had your book for about 10 years, I think it's an amazing work. And yeah, I think we'll just get started on it tonight. And you are welcome to come back and help us to recreate this fascinating period of, you know, that transitional time from the colonies to states. But, we're familiar with Lewis and Clark's explorations up the Mississippi River to the Pacific Northwest and being saved by Sacagawea and sending the souvenirs to Thomas Jefferson, and many of them are still hanging in Monticello or on display there. But William Bartram was doing his trips to South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, about 30 to 40 years prior to Lewis and Clark's exploration of the High Plains. So what sent William Bartram on his travels?
Well, William Bartram, up until he was born in the 1730s, and his whole life he was overshadowed by his father, John Bartram, who at the time was a more famous a person because he was a collector and a botanist who was known in Europe. John Bartram intended William to go into the mercantile business, which, and William Bartram, to his credit, tried to do that for a number of years, but it was the one thing that he was probably completely unsuited for. His personality didn't lend itself to that kind of work. And he wanted to do something that was completely unreasonable, which was he wanted to be an artist and study plants. But you can't make a living at that, although John Bartram's agent in England, Peter Collinson, would sell William Bartram's drawings that when they would send them over there. But at a point in the, in 1765, John and William Bartram came to the South because John Bartram was botanist to the king in North America. He went to East Florida to make a report on the land and, so that England could know what they had because it had been Spanish territory and then in the early 1760s became a British possession. And William Bartram fell in love with Florida and he wanted to stay and become a planter. So he got some land and tried to become an indigo and planter. And he failed miserably and almost died and had to sell out. And it was kind of, after that, he, I guess, a midlife crisis. And he wanted to go back to the South and was hired by, or funded by, Dr. John Fothergill of in England to travel in the Southern colonies where other people had not been looking for plants, to search for plants to send back to Dr. Fothergill, because at the time, wealthy, educated people in Europe loved to collect plants, and if they could get a plant that somebody else didn't have, then they could share it with them in kind of a, it was kind of a good-natured one-upsmanship, and you could get attention and importance by having a plant that other people wanted. So Bartram, William came south in 1773, and John Fothergill paid him £40 a year to travel and look for plants. That's how William got back to the South. But anybody who reads Bartram's travels knows that he didn't stick to his assignment of looking for plants, or he didn't stick to it completely. He looked at the animals, and he wanted to travel, and he lived among the Indians, and he learned about the Indians. And that's how he got to the South, and that's how he was able to travel and just collect plants, was because he was funded to do that.
Okay, so... early in your book, you do mention that botany at that time was almost kind of like synonymous with like a pharmaceutical industry, but you make it very clear that William was, his intention was to help humanity.
Yes. Some of the earlier explorers, like Mark Catesby, part of his publication was, and some of his work and exploration was funded by a pharmacist, because that's where you got drugs and at that time medicines. And William Bartram was learning from his father. He was interested in plants for their beauty and their interest to humanity, because that fit in with his Quaker beliefs that things that would help people were important. But but at the same time, his Quaker sensibility made him open to the beauty of nature, because he saw this as the handiwork of God. And I don't know if it was a conflict in Bartram's mind that he was conscious of, but in his writing, he'll write about prairie in Gainesville, Florida, a beautiful description of the the animals running through the prairie and the sun setting and the sandhill cranes. And then farther down the road towards the Suwannee River, he'll talk about the landscape, and it would be a beautiful place for cities and for humanity to live and flourish. And you can't have both of them together, because, you know, once you come in and build those farms in the cities, and a lot of that beautiful nature, it may not be gone, but it's altered. But that, to me, that's a conflict that keeps popping up, is that what makes this book so beautiful is that he was one of the first people who wrote about nature from a personal viewpoint and his impression of it, and it being the handiwork of God, rather than just writing about it scientifically. And that's if he had just been a scientist writing about it, we wouldn't be still talking about him very much today.
Well, you do have some great passages that you highlight from his Bartram's travels and put them in your text to highlight what you're discussing. And so with these, you know, so some of these plants that he's discovering, like the bottle brush buckeye, is that the foundation for any medicine, or do you know what the importance of that plant it is, or is it just, you know, that he was like the first person to discover it?
He was the first person to discover it. I don't know if bottle brush buckeye has any medicinal value. You know, a lot of plants at one time did have medicinal value, but now they don't, because, you know, medicines are synthesized. But bottle brush buckeye is endemic to from the Chattahoochee River west of Georgia through central Alabama. And he saw it and wrote about it, and he did a drawing of it, but somebody else got to get credit for naming it, because Bartram's descriptions of his plants were not complete enough for science to give him credit for naming them. But we give him credit for discovering them, because, you know, he did a painting 20 years before somebody else described it. But there is one. He and his father did discover one plant. It's called the fever tree, Pycnea pubens, and it does have medicinal value because it has quinine in it, and it's related to the chinchona. I think it's the chinchona tree of South America, where natural quinine is derived. And in the colonial times, in the early 1800s, settlers in South Georgia, North Florida, would make a tea of it to help relieve fever. And I don't know if...
Interesting.
Quinine was used originally to help with malaria. And I don't know if the Pycnea of Georgia has any value with malaria, but it was used to relieve fever. So there's that one. And he discovered golden St. John's wort on the Flint River in West Georgia. And I think St. John's wort does have some medicinal values, but I don't really, can't really say.
Interesting. Okay. So he, Bartram's documenting these plants. He also becomes one of the first white people colonists to write about the giant oysters. I thought that was pretty interesting. Fossils, because we know from was it the Big Bone Salt Lick in Kentucky that native peoples were using some of the like mastodon tusks that were found in the quicksand, and you know, they're using them for some of the ceremonies and like supports for their tents. So it's interesting how in the natives were already aware of fossils.
Yes.
And
these fossils, the giant oysters, John and William Bartram discovered them in 1765. And I've seen some of the fossils. I don't know much about them other than that.
No, I'm like so many other people in the audience. Anything dinosaur is super cool. I read that and I was like, oh wow, that's really interesting. But you know, aside from very old fossil remains, you draw our attention to waterways along the coast that would later be developed into the intercoastal waterway that runs throughout most of the South. I think that's pretty. He didn't have, wasn't like directly responsible for the, his blueprints were used 200 years later, but he's observing for the first time something that would be developed much later. That takes a special eye to pick up on the geography of the area and realize there's like some kind of potential there.
Yeah. Well, from was he was one of the first people to write about it, but he observed it because the coastal boats that he was on going from Charleston to Savannah to Darien, from St. Augustine up, he noticed that the boats stayed between the islands and the coast. They didn't go out to sea, so he wrote about traveling from Darien to Sunbury, and they never went out to sea. And then he expounded upon that. And George Washington was the first person to propose the intracoastal waterway, or the first person that we know of who actually wrote about it, that the government should propose that. But Bartram was uncannily observant, and you're talking about the giant oysters in the Mississippi River. He noticed fossilized tree trunks near the water, but there were dozens of feet of land, earth over them. So he says, well, how is it that here are trees, but then earth is on top of them now? And so he writes about how over time, what was a swamp here later became land, and now it's being revealed again. And that worked in some of the early geologists who came to North America. I'm trying to remember the British geologist, his name escapes me, who wrote one of the first books of geology, traveled in the United States and mentioned about Bartram's observations of geology and how this forest in ancient times became covered with land.
Very interesting. And, you know, since we're dealing with some of the water settings, Bartram was one of the first people to write about Florida alligators, and no one believed his European readers had just a disbelief about these huge, like, you know, lizards in their colonies. But that's an interesting story, as well as the manatees. The native people obviously were well aware of such wildlife, but he brought them almost like 200 years before Marlon Perkins was doing his Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. He's bringing these animals to his reading audience.
Right. And particularly people who, Eastern United States and in Europe, were complete, you know, they were just amazed and awe of, there were things like this in the world, in the North America. But the alligators. And another thing was Bartram's writing about the Indians. Before he wrote about the Indians, there wasn't much written about them for people in Europe, other than they caused trouble. And Coleridge, who wrote Xanadu,
yes,
pulled some of his imagery of ancient landscapes and, you know, non-modern landscapes from Bartram's writings about Florida and the Seminole Indians riding across Payne's Prairie in Florida.
I did not know that. Yeah, and I know Coleridge would have been a contemporary with Bartram, and Coleridge was supposed to settle along the Susquehanna River in Pennsylvania and develops some kind of Unitarian type compound for parishioners.
Oh,
So that I never heard that until you just mentioned it. I'm just wondering how, that may actually, you know, put things into perspective.
Yeah. Well, the Europeans, Bartram was published, his book was available in Europe just a year after it was first published in Philadelphia. And within a few years, it was in German, Italian, French, Spanish, and English, of course. And so people in Europe who were educated knew about Bartram. It was more for a while in Europe, in the late 17 and early 1800s, than it was in North America. Some people think that, you know, part of that's, you know, the prophet has no honor in his own home. Part of it may have been people's resentment of his appreciation of the American Indians and treating them like they were decent human beings. But a lot of it was people in Europe, there were armchair travelers. And here was a book that had stuff in it that they had never seen, had read before, and could only imagine what it was like. And they loved it.
And you know, throughout your book, you have all these numerous encounters of Bartram being amongst the Cherokee, and you do say that he wanted to have his readers understand the indigenous people that he met in their own context and saw that their culture as having a complex symbolism and a structure to it, which is kind of little 180 degree difference from what many Europeans imagined. What you're saying was that Bartram put create realistic portrayals of people that let him live with them.
Yes. The thing about William Bartram and the Indians is that he was thrust in their society, and he was interested in learning about them and asked questions. He was one of the he wrote the most about their culture, particularly the Creek Indians and the Seminoles, their history, how they thought of the animals. How their towns were arranged, what their ceremonies were. And the other people who actually lived among the Indians, the traders, because the Indian traders would generally live lived in a town like Talisi. If you were the trader for Talisi, you lived right at the edge of the Talisi town. And quite often the traders would have an Indian wife. And in their letters, they would write things about the Indians, but these were all little bits and pieces. And nobody ever thought it worthwhile to write down. He was an ethnographer and wrote down things that we would not know today. And in fact, I knew somebody who lived near me, who lived here in Northeast Georgia, who was a member of the Creek Indian Nation east of the Mississippi, and he said that when they were trying to recreate some of their ceremonies, sometimes they would have to refer to Bartram because he wrote it down. And even though there were educated Creek Indians, you know, in the leadership who could read and write, that was not a thing they did. They did not write them down. They would, you know, it would be word of mouth from generation to generation. So Bartram's observations, and they trusted him, one thing, because he was a Quaker, and the Quakers had a good reputation among the Cherokee and the Creeks. But when they got to know him, there was something about William Bartram that made people like him. And wish I could have met the guy. But and the people trusted him, too. And, you know, there's that famous story in on the St. John's River near Palatka, Florida, the Indians had a little village near the trading store so that they would have a place to stay for a few days when they were in trading. And there was an uproar one day, and there was a rattlesnake in the campground. So they came to get William Bartram to do something about it, and he said that he didn't want to kill the snake, but he felt that he needed to for their peace of mind. And so he threw a rock at it or a stick and it killed the snake. And then the Indians wanted to they said he had too much power. They wanted to scratch him and release some of his power and some of his blood. But it's interesting that they came to him for help because they knew that there was something different about him, and that he loved animals, and they thought that he had some kind of special connection with them. I guess is all I can figure.
And since we're talking about some of the customs he observed, you know, you do have thorough overviews of, you know, the regional history, like the Creek Wars, which were, you know, a little after Bartram had returned into the Philadelphia area, but you know, we may not be aware of, you know, the building of the federal road and how that impacted the native peoples and, you know, led to the first of two Creek Wars. But that little bit of information that kind of is leading us towards the more well-known Trail of Tears that we read about in high school history classes. So you are in your book, you are providing us with a fuller history of the starts and stops and all these struggles going on, changing alliances with the Spanish no longer in Florida and English moving in, some of the cultural practices had gone from like a hunting gathering culture to more agricultural society. So, you know, Brad, you are giving us a comprehensive view of, you know, the 1760s to, approaching 1820, and, you know, like a 60-year time period that probably a lot of people don't know a whole lot about.
Mm-hmm.
But, you make it relevant to us today.
Well, my approach was, as I was reading Bartram's travels, I got fascinated by going to the places that he was talking about. And so, my book grew out of that as a guide for other people to follow in Bartram's footsteps. And but when you're doing that, you can point out some places that Bartram was and where he was and what where he talked about events and things. But what else is there? And if you go to Savannah, Georgia, there's a lot of history. There's a lot to do there. But what if you're in Butler County, Georgia, which is midwestern part of the state, And William Bartram went right through that county. So if you're traveling along following William Bartram and you get there, you need to know something about what happened there, why Bartram was going through there, and where are some places where you can go and see maybe something of what Bartram saw. And so, and part of that is the history of the area, because it would go from Indian occupation to white American occupation. And so I pretty much decided to continue the history on to through the end of Bartram's life. And he lived to be in his, I can't remember exactly which year he died, but he was a very old man, almost 90 years old. I believe he died in the sometime in the middle or the late 1820s. It's sad to say, I can't remember when William Bartram died as much as I read about him, but there, you know, there's a lot of facts
July,
to remember.
July 22nd, 1823.
Okay. So I tried to stop history there. And when you're in Alabama, in the central part of Alabama, he traveled through that area, but there was not a lot there at the time because the Creeks lived in the Montgomery area. And then there was Mobile, and there were a few little villages down there. So in that whole area, there weren't any settlements. So what can you talk about if you're traveling that road? And what I try to do is have people follow what became the old federal road, because it was laid down upon the trading path that Bartram followed. And a lot of history happened along there, but a lot of it happened after Bartram left. But the first Creek War was 1814, 15 in that area during Bartram's lifetime, and he would have read about it in the papers. And certainly some of the young people that he met would be involved in that war.
Brad, since you were just mentioning, driving through Butler County, Georgia, the federal road, going through the Gulf Coast states, you are working with a group, the National William Bartram Heritage Corridor. That sounds like you and your group have a really neat idea going on to preserve history. Can you tell us a little bit about what your group has as an objective?
Yes, but I want to correct a mistake I just made. It was not Butler County, Butler, Georgia, which is in Taylor County.
Oh.
So
okay.
I get them backwards sometimes.
That's all right.
I'm a member of the Bartram Trail Conference, and rather than Bartram Trail Society, it's called Conference because it was organized in 1976 by the governors of seven southern states to a committee to meet in conference several times a year and study the William Bartram's travels in the South to see if it was feasible for it to become a national recreational trail. The National Trails Act had been passed in the late 60s, and when all of the paperwork was being done and there were possible national trails, a Bartram Trail was one of them. And the National Park Service does feasibility studies, so they have to have input from you know, lots of information and input from local areas and the local states and everybody that's involved. So the Barnstrom Trail Conference gathered a lot of information about William Barnstrom and the Barnstrom Trail and where he traveled. And a lot of that work had been done in the 1940s by Francis Harper. But the Barnstrom Trail Conference published Barnstrom Heritage, a book of their findings. It was their report. It was published in 1979, and that was turned over to the National Park Service. And the National Park Service published the Barnstrom Trail feasibility study, concluded that it did not lend itself to being a national recreational trail because you couldn't walk it from one end to the other like you can the Appalachian Trail, or boat it from one end to the other almost like the Lewis and Clark Trail. And it would not lend itself to being a national historic trail because it's disjointed. But they did say Barnstrom's legacy is worth commemorating, and that we should continue putting together the trails, gardens, historic sites, interpretive centers, interpretive information in museums, and that they would provide $300,000 to continue this effort. But it never happened. And within a few years after that, in the mid-1980s, the National Park Service started organizing our Congress and through the National Park Service created heritage corridors. And when you read the description of a heritage corridor, it is exactly what the National Park Service said that they wanted to happen with the Barnstrom Trail, which never happened. But now we've got 45 national heritage corridors. And for example, one of the most recent ones is the Gullah Geechee Heritage Corridor, which is the coast of Florida, Georgia, up to Charleston, and inland a little ways. And so 45 heritage corridors, and none of them have to do with William Barnstrom. So at our conference, our biennial conference in Baton Rouge in 2017, we agreed to revive the effort and start where we left off and see if we could make it happen again. And the concept is that it's called a string of pearls. For example, to Georgia, Savannah, the waterfront of Savannah, downtown historic district, is part of the String of Pearls. Midway, Georgia, where Barnstrom went to church and he visited a plantation, is another part of it. LeConte Woodmanston property in Liberty County, Fort Barrington on the Altamaha River, Darien, Georgia. These are all part of that. And you get to one from one place to other by driving to them. You wouldn't hike on a hiking trail. And sometimes when you tell people about the Barnstrom Trail, they want to know where do you hike it. And there are some that you can hike, but the whole thing is not a hiking trail. And we're hard to get this going again because you need to find one person in Congress who puts a bill forth requiring the National Park Service to revisit the issue because the National Park Service can't decide to do it on their own. And what we've been doing is creating a lot of publicity, building up our profile in the hopes that somebody will in Congress say, okay, let's get the National Park Service to look into this again. A lot of the work has been done and that we just need that. And if anybody wants to know how this will look, in Florida, they have created, starting with the Barnstrom Trail in Putnam County, all of the sites that Barnstrom visited and mentioned, they've marked in Putnam County. And they combined all of their paddling trails, their biking trails, their hiking trails, and their natural areas are all under the auspices of the Bartram Trail in Putnam County, and it's drawing a lot of tourism. So then Volusia County wanted to do it, and then St. John's County wanted to do it, and then Duval County, and now Alachua County is involved in it. And within a couple of years, all the counties in Florida that William Bartram visited are going to be part of a Bartram Trail in Florida that is like a small version of what we envision the National Heritage Corridor will be. We just have to expand that, build it out into other states. And our focus now is trying to get some interest in Georgia, you know, because Florida can just spill over across the river. And if we can get some people in the coastal counties of Georgia interested, building a William Bartram presence and including him in their interpretation and in their natural recreation, then we can really start gathering a lot of attention, and we'll get somebody in Congress to come on board and make it happen.
Well, it sounds like you have a very worthy project going on, and it's one of the things that I really enjoy about my Tuesday night show is just preserving history. Over the years, I've worked on a variety of such projects, and I think they're very gratifying when they come to fruition. Think about the popularity of the Dickensian and Jack the Ripper walks of London.
Oh yes.
There are books. I have one, the Charles Dickens, tours of London. There are a number of books on, those walks, and they have a whole bunch of other ones, Shakespeare's London walks. I went on the Dickens and Jack the Ripper walks, and they were very well attended. I hope that you're able to generate that kind of enthusiasm for what you're hoping to do.
Well, I hope so too. William Bartram is significant for the study of natural history in the southeast of the United States. For me, and this is what the goal of the Bartram Trail in Putnam County in Florida was all about, was they saw William Bartram as a way to connect all of the study of nature and recreation, the river and their history, all together under the auspices of William Bartram, and that's how they present it. They do a symposium every year, and they have paddles and hikes, and they'll have a walk around town and readings and lectures. But one of the most important things that they do is they have a whole day where every elementary and middle school child in Putnam County learns something about William Bartram. They get to come down to the River Center and learn about William Bartram. And so all those people are going to grow up knowing who William Bartram is. And for me, he's been important because when I was young, if you wanted to, you talked about nature, that meant you had to go to a national park somewhere in the West to see nature. You didn't imagine that it was in your own backyard and that there were significant plants and animals and beauty within walking distance of where you grew up. And that's what William Bartram is important for us, those of us in the southeastern United States, is going back and reading him and getting a real appreciation of what we have right here, the beauty of our own world. He's like He's the mentor or the guardian angel for nature in the Southeast, and helps us interpret it and appreciate it.
Well, do note in your book that, you know, by the time he returned to Philadelphia and, you know, eventually went into retirement, he is having all these, you know, big names from history visiting him, and as well as, you know, the corresponding with him, you know, the Father Gill in England. He had all these international connections as well. He was lionized by many of the American literati in the scientific community. Someone of that stature really shouldn't have his legacy just forgotten. He really did have unbelievable achievements when there wasn't a very sporadic, inconvenient modes of transportation in undeveloped parts of the country, and, you know, he lived to tell about it.
Yes, although according to him, he almost didn't live to tell about it. But you know, the beginning you were talking about Lewis and Clark.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a person in this country who went through public school education and not know who Lewis and Clark is. And it's because they figured into this, you know, the concept of American history that people enjoy, the expansion and the adventures that they had. And but people have a cursory knowledge of what they saw and what they did. So people know about Lewis and Clark. That's part of American history. That's part of America. But mm-hmm. they don't know so much about William Bartram. And William Bartram, for, you know, the 1800s and half of the 1900s, he was known to people who were interested in natural history and people who were interested in early American writing. But he wasn't taught in school. And I think that he wasn't taught, and what he wrote about didn't figure into the scheme of American exceptionalism and American expansion. So it seems to be changing. I think that people now have a different need to know about America, American history, and the relationship with nature and the landscape has changed also. So I think his time has come. People are really more books about William Bartram have been written in the last 15 or 20 years than in the previous 200 years. And in fact, every year there's several new books that come out about William Bartram. That didn't happen in the 1960s and 70s and 80s.
And one of the many aspects that makes your book so unique, there are all kinds of maps, a modern highway system overlaid with the creeks and rivers. You have little markers. Hey, you know, 3 miles down the road from, you know, once you cross over in this county, you got this little you know, place where you can pull off the road, and this Bartram did this here. It's all right there, very handy. But you know, you also recreate what's the word, like the gentility, is that the right word, where someone of his scientific reputation was invited to stay with like the governor or the mayor of Savannah, something like that, it's a very important person in town, opens the like governor's mansion to Bartram. You also create recreate that such and such a church, Bartram heard, reverends, so and so, and that was like a big deal. Some of these ministers were celebrities at that time.
Right.
And
William Bartram having been in the South in 1765 with his father, John being appointed botanist, King's botanist in North America, of course, had an introduction to all of the people in government and had to meet with them. And William Bartram came back, he still had some of those connections, but he, through Father Gill and Peter Collinson, and through his father, he was able, every important person in Charleston saw and talked with William Bartram. And there were so few people in East Florida that he met and knew everybody in the government. And and he would mention people who since have become important figures in history of Georgia and Florida, and names that we read when we're getting down into the documents. And it is kind of fascinating how he'll just mention someone, and then in your other readings you run across that person's name again. But every important person in Georgia and South Carolina knew William Bartram personally, met him and talked to him.
It's interesting. Your book takes us back to a time that it no longer exists, but we see how things were done between people, social custom, talk about, just between, the white settlers and natives, people, Northerners visiting people in the South. We see a study of manners, and I believe you only mentioned once that Bartram was denied staying in someone's house. But, most people were very welcoming to travelers, as well as specifically to Bartram. He's nice to have a celebrity knock on your door and ask if they could stay there.
Mm-hmm.
but it is one of the neat things about your book is you do a great job of recreating where these places are located. Savannah, many of the buildings are still standing, and some of the governor's mansions are still there. But you document where all these events happened, and needing to wind down real quickly, but I did want to bring up one passage where you do write on page 191, this indicates that Bartram was traveling on the west side of the river at Otto. Probably Bartram crossed the east to the west side of the Little Tennessee River near the graves of the fallen Cherokee warriors, just a mile or so north of the state line. This site is commemorated with a historical marker. So, do you find that when you driving this section of where feel pretty certain that Bartram was visiting, and then you kind of juxtapose his text with what you're seeing, do you think that your book may be pinpointed a little bit more accurately, where some of his journals might be a little fuzzy?
Well, there's some places where my opinion differs from what Francis Harper's opinion was in the 1940s and what the Bartram Trail Conference Heritage Report thinks, because I've revisited the sites and read, and I keep looking for old maps. And unfortunately, in 1773, there are no maps the maps for that time were good, but they're not that good. It's like the road goes from here to there, but it doesn't show you where it crosses the creek, and there's just not that much detail. And I think one of my faults, one of the problems with what I'm doing is I sometimes get bogged down in trying to figure out Tennessee River and Macon County, North Carolina. Where would the trail have gone? Where did Bartram cross over to this side? Where did he cross over to the other side? And at some point, you just have to give up and say, he probably did this. He may have done that. We don't know. And there are a couple of cases where I'll give two routes, and then the new maps, they'll have a question mark on each one. So he could have gone this way. He could have gone that way. He's vague enough in some situations that it makes for work, but that's what makes it fun. If you have to work for it, if you didn't have to work for it, it wouldn't be any fun. So that's why I enjoy it.
No, it is interesting. I noticed that in a couple places where we kind of think maybe he was here, but this one treaty kind of moved the Cherokee out of the area, so we kind of aren't sure. But I think he was going between this town, and it's now Route 41 or something like that. It is interesting, but you are using the old maps, what we do know, without you know, Bartram having a GPS in the 1770s. It is interesting. You know, you do put forth a really nice effort to pinpoint things a little bit more specifically than Bartram wrote about. But, you know, like you said, you know, he didn't have access to the road signs and mile markers and, you know, that we have today. But, you know, that's one of the neat things about reading your book and recreating, you know, it's like, you know, the Canterbury Tales. Yeah, you just kind of, you get the people on the road going east, and, like, you know, Chaucer mentions, you know, like, this, inn or something like that. And, you know, we knew that was a real place, but we aren't sure exactly where one of the characters told the story. But, you know, you're just kind of like dealing with the same thing. He's going this direction, probably down this street, but or down this road, but we don't know exactly where. But your whole book, Guide to William Bartram's Travels, is, you know, really well done. And, you know, you have all the maps and, you know, the important buildings in the town where he may have stayed. And I think it's really a terrific book. And I just wanted to bring it to the attention of our listeners. And, you know, the corridor project, we at Nightlight really enjoy preserving history. And, Brian, I know, we're running a few minutes late, but, I'll give you, a few minutes if you want to wrap up anything, and you can get back to, what you were doing on the work you were doing on a Tuesday evening.
Well, my book is out of print right now, and I'm working on updating it, which is taking as long as doing the update as the original writing did, probably because I'm a lot more thorough and know a lot more now than I did in the 1990s. But the Bartram Trail Conference has a website, bartramtrail.org, and it's got a lot of information about, we've got maps, we've got a Google map that's got Bartram's route that we, you know, as best as we can get it correct, and points on the map. It's got information about his travels through the different states, and the Bartram Trail Conference Heritage Report that was published in 1979 is available on our website as a PDF, so people can see what the work that was done that got all this started. And we try to keep the website updated as best we can, but, you know, with all volunteer people, it's kind of hard to do. But that's a good place to get started. And the reason why I did my book was I kept wanting to go to the places that William Bartram wrote about. I wanted to see what he saw, you know, the town and the nature. And that's what I was trying to do, is give people a resource where they could go to some place they'd never been before and learn something about that place, its history and its natural history. And William Bartram is their guide. And that's why I did what I did, and that's why the maps were important. And you can get a pretty good map on the on our website. So I encourage everybody to check that out, bartramtrail.org. I think that's all I can think of at the moment. Unless you have any more questions.
I'll just be glad to have you come back at some point. You know, I think we covered everything. I know you have a little bit more to do tonight. You know, I just don't want to keep away from that. But, you know, Brad, I just wanted to thank you for your passion in preserving history. You know, Barbara and I are all in favor of that subject, and you know, we're glad to have so many people from different backgrounds talking about the different projects that they're working on. You know, we've done that for years, and just nice to have you bring a new topic that wanted to add to our roster of historic preservation.
Oh, I enjoy it. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we had Brad Sanders as our guest, and you can get a call.